Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world. Hello and welcome to the Daily Briefing. Today is Monday, August 8th. Amanda Borchel Dunn here with our political correspondent, Tal Schneider, and diplomatic correspondent, Lazer Berman, who is joining us again from Ukraine. Hello to you both.
Hi, Amanda.
Good morning.
Today, Israel awoke cautiously optimistic to the news that the Egyptian brokered ceasefire that went into effect last night at 11:30 has held. We will discuss more ripple effects of the three-day operation Breaking Dawn, as well as what is happening with the war in Ukraine. And Tal will bring us updates from politics. First, let me update you on what we know about the 66 hours of fighting in numbers. Since Friday, some 1,100 rockets were fired at Israel. 200 fell short in Gaza, with 380 interceptions at a 95 to 97% rate. Military correspondent Emmanuel Fabian shared this morning that the IDF believes that 35 were killed in Gaza, 11 of whom were uninvolved in Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Another 16 Gaza residents were killed by failed rockets from the Islamic Jihad. Let's begin with you, Lazer. We're all hoping that the ceasefire holds, obviously, but tell us about Egypt's role as a mediator, briefly.
So here we are, you know, however you want to count it, what is this, the fifth, sixth, seventh round of major fighting between Israel and terrorist organizations in the Gaza Strip. What, as usually happens, Egypt ends up being the moderator between the sides. Whether it's with Hamas, whether it's Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Israel's connections to Egypt's security establishment have historically been very tight. And it is a role that Israel and the United States are comfortable with, and Egypt seems to do it well. It certainly has interests to maintain calm on its border. Now, Egypt this time as well did play the part of a broker. It was able to mediate a stop to this fighting after 3 days. And I think that this is what Israel wanted. It seems like Israel, as happens in these type of operations, usually in the first couple of days, there's some high priority targets. There was those two Islamic Jihad operatives, one in the northern Gaza Strip, one in the southern Gaza Strip, that Israel was able to take out. But after that, it starts to have trouble finding valuable targets, and increasingly, you know, civilians are killed and mistakes are made, and that starts to accumulate a cost for Israel. So I think Israel was relieved to have a way out of this, a way down, to step down from the tree it climbed up on after a few days. And that allows both the political leadership to say, okay, we were able to respond forcefully without letting this get out of hand, to show responsibility and to not upset Israel's allies in the world.
So that really dovetails with my next question for you. What were the international reactions to Operation Breaking Dawn?
So I think Israel can generally be pleased with the reactions. The United States, both in the person of Joe Biden, the National Security Council spokesman John Kirby, Tom Nides, they all stressed the importance of America's backing, of Israel's right to defend itself. That was certainly there in all their statements. They did express concern, of course, over Palestinian civilian deaths. Nides tweeted his support for the ceasefire and also stressed that Israel and Palestinians both deserve equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and dignity. That is language that the Biden administration uses quite regularly. But also Nides stressed again U.S. commitment to Israel's security being ironclad. So I think Israel can be certainly happy with that. In Europe, whether it's France, whether it's the United Kingdom's foreign secretary, the response was good, and also among Israel's Abraham Accords partners. So UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, there were responses that were not problematic for Israel. Interestingly, the Turkish response, I think, should worry Israel, if indeed it wants to get back and to relations that have been quite positive in the past, and to swap ambassadors again. The Turkish response did not mention the rocket fire on Israeli civilians. It expressed concern over civilian deaths in the Gaza Strip. So I think that was a return to the type of rhetoric we've seen from Turkey in the past, though not quite as strident and acerbic as you know, some of the worst statements that have come out of Erdogan. But that's probably not especially encouraging for Israel.
Lazer, you just attended a phone briefing on the operation with senior Israeli officials. What did you hear?
That's right, Amanda. The first thing that the Israeli officials, senior Israeli officials, stressed was that so far they're happy with the way the ceasefire has held up, and they're starting to look toward the next phase. So that indicates that there's confidence that this is going to hold up, and they feel comfortable with that. The next phase, they seem optimistic about. They say there's an opportunity here that they don't want to miss. They're not happy with just a ceasefire with Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but they want this to create progress on larger issues, especially the issue of Israeli civilian captives and the bodies of soldiers held by Hamas. So there's some optimism that this could create some positive momentum. The officials also explained some of the lead up to the operation. They said they had hoped that this wouldn't expand in the way it did, that they hoped that Hamas would be able to pressure Palestinian Islamic Jihad to withdraw its intentions to attack Israel, to use anti-tank squads, snipers, to extract some measure of revenge for the arrest of one of its senior leaders in the West Bank. They say that failed, and then they understood that they were headed toward an operation. Throughout, Israeli officials said that they wanted to contain it. They wanted to make sure it did not expand into a fight with Hamas. And they understood pretty early on that Hamas was not interested in a fight and that Hamas played a positive role in pressuring Pidge to wrap up the operation and to agree to a ceasefire. They were also, not surprisingly, very positive and praised the role that Egypt plays. They praised their active role. Obviously, United States, Jordan, and Qatar. They called Qatar a player that is responsible or that plays a meaningful role in economic stability in the Gaza Strip. So it seems like Israeli officials are very happy with their diplomatic efforts to both explain the reasons for heading toward an escalation and for wrapping it up quickly. So it's a positive note coming from Israeli officials. The question is, what happens next? Israeli officials were pretty adamant that they're not about to release the two senior Palestinian Islamic Jihad officials that are being held, that the organization wants to be released as part of a ceasefire. They say there was no agreement on Israel's part to release these officials. One of them is a hunger striker who's being held in detention without charges. The other one is the West Bank leader who was arrested last week, and that's what really sparked this latest round. And so Israel is not about to release them and seems not to be willing to release them, to even consider releasing them early at all. So that is the latest update. And, so far the ceasefire is holding, and we'll keep an eye on that. And as I said, Israeli officials expect it to hold and expect this to create positive momentum moving forward.
Tal, turning to you, we touched on the fact that in Israeli politics, in times of conflict, old grudges can be set aside yesterday. Did you see anything remarkable happen during the operation?
Well, we saw a security briefing by the head of opposition, Benjamin Netanyahu, going up to the prime minister office in Tel Aviv, actually, and being briefed by Yair Lapid. This is like a mirror of the relationship. You know, we've been used for years to see Netanyahu briefing those opposition leaders and taking a photo of him sitting at the top of the table giving that briefing. And for the first time in many years, we saw Netanyahu being briefed by Lapid. That now, it must be said that Lapid, who entered the prime minister office about 6 weeks ago, suggested that Netanyahu will be briefed immediately. And Netanyahu refused, saying he doesn't want to be pictured together because of the political sensitive timing. However, you know, even when we have election all the time, this is the fifth election cycle, those security briefings are really crucial for, I mean, they're obliged under the law, but also they're crucial for the country to see the two leaders cooperating. And we saw that picture yesterday. As I said, it was overdue and it happened. So it was good. I think also the opposition kept mum. They did not criticize too much. They were, as we say in Israel, playing mamlachti, playing, you know, diplomat, no charging against Lapid at all. But I'm pretty sure that as of today or tomorrow, we'll hear a lot of sound bites with remarks and some things to be said. One of the, you know, things that Yair Lapid is being criticized already is that he started on Friday the military operation without a proper cabinet, security cabinet pre-approval. The law is not so strict in Israel. There is a narrowed down forum that can allow those things to happen. So the criticism is a little bit problematic, obviously coming from Netanyahu, who downsized himself the forum that can start an operation. But still, I think it's a worthy criticism, and it's worth to discuss that in the public arena. So I'm pretty sure the Likud will come up with something regarding that.
What else can we look forward to this week in politics and primaries, no?
Yeah, Amanda, it's a very, very busy week. Israel's biggest party is holding the primaries on Wednesday. Even before that, a small party, the Labour, is holding primaries on Tuesday. So Tuesday is Labour and Wednesday is Likud. Lots of candidates. Both parties were thinking maybe to postpone the primaries because of the operation. However, Labour primaries, which are first on Tuesday, it's mostly an electronically vote. So it's not a gathering, as opposed to the Likud on Wednesday, in which they have to show up at locations to vote. I think both parties are holding the primaries as scheduled. Specifically for Labour, who have 5 to 6 seats in the polls, they were hoping for some sort of a bump as a result of the primaries. And it cannot take place when you have all of the country dealing with security problems. So I think the reason for them to want to postpone their primaries was in order to get some more media attention. But probably it's not going to happen. They will hold it as scheduled. The Likud, it's the biggest primaries, over 70 candidates, around 30-something spots that are maybe or may not be in the Knesset. So it's a big event. Lots of tension in the top of the Likud. Some members of the Likud, currently serving members of the Knesset or ministers may fall out. It's just, really big political event on Wednesday.
Excellent. We will update, of course. We're going to a short break now.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
The Jewish Quarterly is the leading international journal of ideas and culture. In the August issue, Kim Gattis investigates Iran's 43-year quest to dominate the Middle East. Aryeh Dubnov casts light on Israel's first native Hebrew speaker. William Miles reports on the Jews of the West Indies, plus features on the Ukraine pogroms, the Sassoon dynasty, and Hannah Arendt. Jewish Quarterly, out now at good booksellers worldwide or subscribe at jewishquarterly.com. And we're back. Laser, you're joining us from Ukraine. Where specifically are you and what are you seeing and experiencing right now?
So right now I am back in Kyiv, the capital. I was here for Shabbat. Last week I was in Kharkiv in the northeast, which is quite close to the front lines. And I also made a trip down 12 hours of driving in that day to Mykolaiv. I was trying to get to the front lines there. Mykolaiv is on the is near the southern coast. It's near the city of Kherson, which is the largest city held by the Russians. And that is a front which is heating up. It seems like Ukraine is gearing up for a counteroffensive in that region. The Russians are also reinforcing troops there. I was trying to get closer to the front lines, but the city was shut down shortly after I left. So civilians couldn't even leave their houses for 3 days. So I was not able to get close enough to the front lines. I did, however, speak to Jewish and Israeli citizens who have formed their own unit that has been fighting and conducting quite dangerous operations. So I was able to speak to some of them. I'm trying to reach some more before I write about it, but that was certainly something interesting.
That is extremely fascinating. What is the name of their unit?
It's called Masada. There was an initial unit that fought in the early months of the war. That unit broke up, and then one of the soldiers there who fought in the IDF as well, he's originally Ukrainian, spoke to him in Hebrew the whole time. He moved back to fight. He kind of reformed a second Masada unit, which is Israelis, some Jews. I spoke to a Jewish Italian who is also in that unit. So it's mostly Israelis and Jews, and then there's a couple other people as well. It's a small unit, but it's kind of a special forces type of thing. So I met them in a restaurant. I will be writing about that. And so that was my Mykolaiv. So I was not able to get as far as I wanted to go. Interestingly, though, in Kyiv, I have been speaking to fiancés, mothers, sisters of Ukrainian prisoners of war. So you might have heard about the July 29th blast in the Olenivka prisoner of war camp in Russian-held Ukraine, where the Russians say that 50 Ukrainian POWs were killed. They blame Ukraine for this. This is kind of a ridiculous claim, but that's what it is. These women have had their loved ones, they know that they've been taken away, that they know that they're prisoners of war. They've mostly been able to speak to them in the days and weeks following their capture, but have not been able to speak to them recently. Some of them know that their loved ones were in Olenivka. They do not know what has happened to them. So there is a not insignificant chance that their fiancés, sons, were indeed killed in this. They just literally don't know. What they're trying to do now is just write to everyone that they can, try to put some pressure on Russia and on the Red Cross to be more forthcoming in the names and of the prisoners of war who are there, to allow access, to follow the international laws of war about prisoners of war. We in Israel have been very critical of organizations like the UN and the Red Cross, Amnesty. We're hearing that a lot here as well. They say that these organizations are not doing what they're supposed to do. Right now, it's the Russian Red Cross, Russian branch of the Red Cross, which is supposed to have responsibility for the Ukrainian prisoners. Not surprisingly, they want that responsibility to be transferred to another organization. They have not made any direct appeals to Israel yet. They did meet with the chief rabbi here in Kyiv, Rabbi Asman, to ask him to intercede with Israel. I spoke to Israeli officials. They said they have not received any requests from Ukrainians about arranging a prisoner swap. So this is really a heart-wrenching story. You speak with these women. At first, I thought they were just kind of cold and unfriendly, but that you very quickly realize it's because they are just kind of bottling up their emotions. The emotions do come out. Almost every single one of them started crying when she was telling the story. Some of these people, there was one mother from Mariupol who lost her mother right before the war. Her father died on March 31st. Her son was taken into captivity sometime in late March when the Russians captured the city. That's her only son. So literally all she has now is a son who may or may not still be alive. She fled Mariupol, and now she spends her days writing letters and trying to get someone to really do something that will be helpful. So they were eager to get their stories out on the one hand, but obviously it was very difficult for them to talk about it. So this is going to be a story I'm going to write. I have also heard about a Holocaust survivor that she has a grandson who was captured in the Azov steel plant as well. So I'm going to see if I can speak to her as well and tell that story.
Laser, heartbreaking stories. I look forward to reading about them on the Times of Israel website in the near future. Tal, thank you so much for the updates, and we'll hear more from you in the near future about the primaries.
Thank you, Amanda.
Listeners, please check into the website to get updated on the lingering effects of Operation Breaking Dawn. Thank you, both of you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time,
Shalom.